Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How is China's economic growth affecting visions of the future for the country's youthful workforce? An estimated 130 million of today's Chinese laborers are migrants, many of whom abandon the small rural villages that raise them in search of better pay, better living conditions, and greater autonomy. And China's exploding urban centers do offer new experiences and opportunities, but also risks and obstacles that would test the resolve of any of us, let alone young women who leave home while still in their teens. Leslie T. Chang spent a decade living in China as a correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. She expands on some of the stories she first covered as a newspaper reporter in her new book, Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China. Leslie, welcome back to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What image do most rural Chinese have of the city and the life there before they leave? Do they know what to expect?
Well, increasingly they do, because migration is now has become quite an entrenched phenomenon in China over the past two decades. So in the early years of economic reforms, probably in the 80s and early 90s, people were really heading out into the unknown. And, you know, what these earlier migrants often said to me was they had no idea what a city looked like, what a train ride was like, what a factory looked like. But now in this past decade, what we're seeing is that young people are leaving the village in droves and they're hearing stories from the city, the opportunity, you know, the McDonald's, the nice shopping malls. So they have a sense of the sort of glamour and opportunity that the city might bring them.
I really like the way that you describe this, particularly for some girls that you meet in the very beginning of the book. You say they were 16 years old, on the loose in one of China's most chaotic boom towns, raising themselves with no adults in sight. They were prey to all sorts of cons, making life decisions on the barest bits of information. They missed their mothers, but they were also having the time of their lives. And that seems to be a component that we don't think about very much when we consider China's new workforce.
That's right. That was kind of my starting point, because I had been a reporter at the Wall Street Journal in China for a number of years, beginning in 1998. And what I realized was that a lot of people, including my own newspaper, had done stories about factory life, but they mostly focused on the worst conditions, you know, the abuses and exploitation. And I started thinking, you know, what is it like to be a young teenage, you know, boy or girl and to come out from the village to the city at the age of 16 or 17 and to be completely on your own? You know, it must be really scary, but it must also be really liberating and exciting. You know, suddenly you're away from your parents and your relatives and everyone who knows anything about you, and you can basically do what you want, you know, which is very scary but also very exciting for a lot of these young people.
Why are 70% of these factory jobs filled by women?
Well, the bosses in the factories say they generally prefer young women because they're more detail-oriented and hardworking and just get into less trouble in general than the men. But this seems to be partly because, you know, there are a lot of gender divides in the workforce in China that to us might seem quite absurd. You know, there are plenty of jobs that both men and women can do, but, you know, for example, sales and secretarial and clerk jobs are seen as the best jobs for women, while, you know, certain technical jobs are only for men. And, you know, this doesn't really make sense, because if you have the skills, you can do the job, but that's still how they're seen. And the fallout from that is that young women actually in the factories have more opportunities to rise than the men do, because they can start out on the assembly line and then maybe take a course in computer skills or typing and then sort of work their way into a job as a secretary or a receptionist and from there move up in the white-collar world. And young men often don't have these opportunities in the factories.
I thought it was really extraordinary that sometimes these women are working 10 and up to 13 hours a day, and yet they find the time and the energy after the workday is over to take classes that they actually pay for themselves to improve themselves.
It's amazing. Yeah, I actually, one of the chapters in the book focuses on what was called a white-collar class, which was teaching young assembly line workers how to dress, act, talk, and conduct themselves in a white-collar office setting. And these young women worked in a couple of electronics factories in Dongguan, the city that I focus on, and after spending, you know, 11 hours or 13 hours on the assembly line, they would immediately get off work, you know, rush to change their clothes, and then come to the class for 2 hours, which ran from 8:30 to 10:30 at night. So, and amazingly, I never saw a single young woman in the class fall asleep or or leave the room or even take a break to go to the bathroom. I mean, they were so focused on learning everything they needed to learn because, as you say, they were spending probably months' wages to be in this class, so they were determined to get everything they could out of it.
And there's almost a magical faith in what those classes will give them. You write about the square and round. I guess it's sort of a self-help book. Can you talk a little bit about that and the sorts of advice that they're receiving?
Yeah, it's really amazing because, you know, we think of self-help, self-improvement as an American kind of phenomenon, but this has taken huge, powerful root in China today, precisely because there's so many young people who are trying to move up in the world. So, you know, when you go into a bookstore in Dongguan, you see all sorts of really bizarre, you know, you see tons of Dale Carnegie books, but then you'll also see weird things, you know, like the 39 Secrets to Wenzhou People's Success, or like, you know, the money-making secrets of Americans, or, you know, all sorts of very strange. And when you open these books, they often have quotes from Ben Franklin and Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry Ford, you know. So it's sort of like they're taking these ideas that were, you know, quite popular in America a century ago when we saw all these people rising up from the factory floor into higher jobs, and they're sort of adapting it to their own situations.
Leslie T. Chang is my guest. Her new book is called Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China. One of the young women that you profile, they're both very interesting, but Chun Ming is this fascinating study in contrast. She is very street smart in some ways and sort of looks out for herself and yet very trusting in the products that she sells and the things that she thinks are going to help her sort of leap to the next level.
Yeah, I found her story interesting. I met her, Chun Ming, when she had been in Dongguan already a decade, and I was curious what life was like for sort of the older migrants, you know, who'd been in the city for a while. What were their concerns? What were their expectations? And what I found was that, you know, even though her financial situation was already pretty stable, you know, she had a good job at, you know, selling paint in a factory, which in Dongguan is considered a good job, and, you know, steady pay, and she rented an apartment. But she was on this constant search for some kind of meaning in her life beyond just having a steady paycheck. And I found that really interesting because our common stereotype of China now is that people are just purely pragmatic and materialistic. And I think, you know, to a large extent, that's true. People are focusing on improving their lives because they haven't had this opportunity for a long time. So now that they have it, they're going to grab it, you know. But someone like Chun Ming, you know, she showed me clearly that people are looking for something more, and her hunger for meaning took her in some very bizarre directions, as you mentioned. You know, for a while she was doing pyramid schemes, selling nutritional supplements, and then she told me that selling life insurance was the way to make people and herself happy. And then the next time I saw her, she'd become a vegetarian, and she thought that was the way to health and bliss. You know, so she was sort of constantly searching for new and often somewhat troubling fads to try to, you know, give meaning to her life.
You talk about her having a relatively good job. Can you talk about what separates a good factory job from one that employees really want to move on from as quickly as they can?
Yeah, I think starting out, you know, most young people, when they come out to the city, the first job is usually a very bad one because they don't have much information and they're just desperate to find a place so they can have something to eat and some place to sleep. So in the time that I was reporting in Dongguan, which was, you know, between 2004 and 2007, a bad job would be, say, you know, 400 or 500 yuan a month, which is about $50 or $60 a month. Long hours, 13, you know, 12 or 13 hours or more on the assembly line, no days off, you know, working day after day for weeks on end, and also just, you know, having bosses that they didn't really trust, not knowing how much pay they would get from month to month, having all sorts of penalties imposed for pretty, you know, frivolous things, you know, like, you know, being 2 minutes late on the assembly line one day, and then it would be taken out of their pay. So that's kind of a typical, and also having pretty poor living conditions, for example, having to share a dorm with 15 or 20 or 30 other people. But usually, you know, from talking to a large number of migrant women, they would move up from this over time. And so if you met a young woman who had a really terrible job, you know, 1 month out from home, and you kept track of her and talked to her 3 months, 6 months, a year later, she would usually have moved up into a better job. And that would be, you know, on the factory floor, that would be, say, $100 a month, 6 days a week working with Sundays off, and reasonable dorms with maybe 10 or 12 workers per room, which still sounds like really harsh conditions to us, but to these young people from the countryside, that's already like a good, stable, steady job. And then from there, the more ambitious ones would want to move up into white-collar office work, which is usually starting off being a secretary or a clerk or a sales assistant, and then hopefully moving up from there.
So there is an opportunity to ascend, not just in economics, but in class, if you work hard enough.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, one of the things about China now is because the economy is growing so fast and people's lives are changing so quickly, that there's incredible social mobility and fluidity in society. And so, you know, in many cases, the young people I knew, it was all they needed to do was take a class and get a little confidence and savvy, and then they could go to the job fair, the talent market, as they call it, and talk their way into a job, you know, off the assembly line into the office. And then, you know, within 1 or 2 years, you would meet them. Actually, this happened in one case. I met this young woman on the factory floor, kept in touch with her, and then I saw her about a year and a half later, and she looked like a middle-class person. You know, her hair was very nicely done, and she was carrying a stylish purse, and she took me to this restaurant and ordered these dishes very confidently, and she talked differently, she dressed differently, and it was sort of like, you know, in a year and a half, she totally transformed from a factory girl into kind of a middle-class office worker.
One really interesting section of the book, I thought, was when you write about one of these, what looks like a pyramid scheme when people are talking about this health product, but they're being trained how to sell this stuff. And for the first time, people who are of the peasant class feel confident enough to speak to other people and to sort of go out in public and represent themselves. And they don't necessarily feel like they have to sort of hide in the shadows because they were born in humble circumstances.
That's right. I think that's a really big change in Chinese society today, because traditionally it was always the men and the most educated people who were seen as, you know, they could stand up in public, they could talk, they could not feel ashamed, really, about their background, and everyone else would be quite apologetic, you know, about not being educated or being from the farming class. And what was striking about these young people in Dongguan, you know, on the factories, was that even though they came from very humble backgrounds, a lot of them had a lot of confidence about where they were going, and you know, a lot of these direct sales and pyramid schemes and sales operations that I explored were about teaching people how to talk, how to sell themselves, how to project a confident air. That was really striking, because when you live in China, and you know, I was reporter there for many years, and even the professors and the officials, when they stand up and give speeches, they're often extremely terrible public speakers, because that's not a really big part of Chinese tradition as it is in America, you know, where, you know, self-expression is a huge part of your education. So, in fact, when I was in Dongguan, what I realized was that a lot of these young migrant workers and salespeople were better speakers than their supposed, you know, more educated countrymen.
So how does this new sort of confidence affect the dynamic when these migrant workers go back home and visit the people that they have grown up with?
Yeah, it's really striking how big a difference there is, you know, how much they change in such a short time. And one of the chapters in the book, I travel with one of the two young women I write about back to her home village for Chinese New Year. And at that time, she had been out from home 2 years, and so this was her first visit back. And I was sort of expecting that she would fall back into a more traditional role, you know, respect for her parents and doing housework and trying to fit back into her role as a daughter. But instead, she was just very dismissive and judgmental about how her family lived and trying to tell them how to live in a more civilized way.
Leslie T. Chang is my guest. Her new book is called Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China. We'll talk more after this break. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly. part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Leslie T. Chang. Her new book is called Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. You are the American-born daughter of Chinese immigrants, but you had lived in China as a journalist for 7 years before you went back to your ancestral home. Why did you wait so long?
That's right. I kind of, I think it was partly just being contrarian. one of the most common things among Chinese Americans when they come to China, when they go to China, is to go back to their ancestral villages and talk to people and sort of explore their roots. And, you know, I can't say in words exactly why I waited so long. I just kind of felt like I wanted to be really prepared, and I wanted to know that whatever I found in the village, I would be able to understand and put in context. And so I wanted to learn a little bit more about China before I did that. And then what happened was I started reporting the book about the factory girls in Dongguan, and I had a leave from the Wall Street Journal, and so I had a little more free time to go back to my ancestral village in northeastern China, from which my grandfather had come out in 1916 as a teenager to go to school and eventually to go to America for further education and then to go back to China. And as soon as I went back to my family village, I realized that there were these interesting parallels between my own family and this kind of century of migration and immigration and leaving home and trying to find a new life, and the stories of these young women who I was meeting and getting to know in contemporary China. So I thought that would be a nice way to frame the book, you know, the history of China over a century as related through my own family and this current factory world, in which sometimes it feels like there's no history, but in fact, obviously, there's a deep, profound past that lies behind it.
Yeah, I think that was a fascinating parallel right there, in that a lot of these young women don't seem to be that interested in China's recent or ancient past. The culture of your family was really not to talk much about what had gone on, but there were probably two very different reasons for that.
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing I did notice when I started reporting my family history was how little people wanted to dwell on their individual stories, and how especially they would just skip over the most painful moments, you know. And as Americans, you know, with a long history of storytelling, we feel like, you know, we expect the opposite. We expect people to tell these stories that play up their individual uniqueness and their sufferings or their triumphs. But, you know, these weren't what I was seeing with my family at all. And I came to feel that it was because China's modern history had been so traumatic on both the national level and on personal terms, that people just sort of had agreed to put it aside because it was too painful to think about and too difficult to understand, you know, what had really happened during times like the Cultural Revolution, when friends turned against each other, when family members, you know, betrayed one another. You know, so that was sort of the backdrop. But then I came to feel that even though Dongguan, this factory town, seemed to have no history, that modern China as it is today, the reason why it's so pragmatic and materialistic and so focused on improving life day by day, I think, is partly because of this traumatic history that came before. You know, I think people are really determined to make something concrete and good of this period, partly knowing, you know, how terrible many things were during this last century.
Dongguan doesn't sound like a particularly pleasant place, but it was you found that it really appealed to you there. Can you talk about why?
I did, yeah. My first visit there in 2004, I got to the city, and it was just, you know, it was a sprawling Chinese city, polluted, chaotic, loud, noisy, and I was suddenly like, oh my gosh, do I really want to be spending time here? You know, what have I gotten myself into? But then the more I got to know the city and to know people in the city, the more I kind of came to see it through their eyes and to feel like, you know, this is China, this is the big city, this is opportunity, and you know, it's, you know, for these young people, it's sort of the greatest thing they've ever seen, you know, and that really came home to me clearly after this 2-week trip in the farming village with one of the young women I write about, Min, and we'd spent 2 weeks in this tiny farmhouse, you know, that, you know, two rooms that she shared with her four siblings, her parents, and the chickens wandering in and out, you know, no plumbing, no heating, wearing all our jackets and hats and gloves every second for 2 weeks. And then at the end of this trip, Min and I took the train back to Dongguan together, and when we got to the city, we're both like, ah, this is so nice. It's warm. There's water. We can take showers, you know. And suddenly I realized, wow, this is what life looks like for a migrant worker, you know.
Yeah, and she saw her own home with really, it's poignant in a way. She's got all this new opportunity, but she'll never be able to look back at her past in the same way.
Yeah, that was one of the most poignant things, was talking to the migrants about their relationship with home. Because especially someone like Min, she would tell me all the time about how beautiful her home was and the mountains and the kinds of flowers and trees. And, you know, many migrants seem quite ashamed of their background, but she seemed really proud of the fact that she came from this beautiful mountain part of the country. But she also knew, and she discovered over time, that she would never go back to this place to live, and that, you know, it was sort of a lost childhood, you know, lost paradise in a way, you know, the realm of childhood that she could never go back to once she had lived in the city and realized that it was so much better there.
Leslie T. Chang is my guest. The book is called Factory Girls. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to ask the guest why she thinks fewer young men have taken on the challenge to elevate themselves in society as opposed to the young women.
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, across China, migration is happening in huge numbers among both men and women. I think rough statistics show maybe two-thirds are male and one-third are female. So, you know, it's not true that women go out in larger numbers than men. What is true is that in the factory towns, in the places that I was reporting, women are, you know, in much larger numbers than men. But if you go to, say, the construction sites in many Chinese cities, it's almost all men. So that's where a lot of the young men are going. But one thing I did feel was that women were often more ambitious and felt more the urgency to rise up and to do something better. And I think that largely comes from the traditional Chinese view that, you know, boys will marry, but then they'll still live in their home with their parents, or their parents might even build a house for them so that they can live there with their new family. But girls basically are seen as, you know, once they marry, they're sort of out of the family. That's kind of the traditional view, so they don't really belong to your family once they're married. So I felt like, in a way, the girls, even though they had fewer privileges, they also had more freedom and more urgency to kind of make something of themselves.
A lot of Americans might remember the Lowell textile mills in Massachusetts, and there was an overwhelming number there of female workers. But the comparison sort of ends there, in that in Lowell, women who were trying to improve their lot would sort of organize and work that way. And what you found was something very different, that everyone, not necessarily in a way that would hurt other people, but they really knew that they could only look out for themselves.
Yeah, I was very interested in the Lowell factory workers, actually, and I did a lot of reading, and at one point I thought about including a chapter about them in the book, because, as you say, there are a lot of similarities, these young women coming from the countryside and working on these assembly lines. You know, one big difference I found was that, well, there are a lot of differences. I mean, one is that America is a country that's built on individualism, and so when you read these diaries and accounts of these young women coming to the city, a lot of it is about opportunity, but there isn't this complete shock and break from everything that they've come from, the way there is in China. And there isn't also this huge divide in America, you know, in that farmers were not seen as the lowest class, the lowliest, the least educated, the dirtiest, the, you know, frankly, somewhat shameful backgrounds. You know, farming was seen as something proud and individualistic and, you know, kind of the frontier history that America is built on. So I think for these young women from Chinese villages to come to the city, it's such a huge break from everything they've come from, and that sort of accounts for this incredible sense of shock and loneliness that they feel, that I think is quite different.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Joe in Dallas. Hello, Joe.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I've seen a documentary a couple weeks back on PBS about people in China was working on a cruise ship or something, and my question is more cultural, I guess. The girl, she had been on the ship for a while, I don't know how long, but she went back to visit her family, to see her mom and dad, and when she first seen them, she kind of stuck her head down a little, but they didn't hug like we would have, and I don't know if that was just their family or if she can speak to that, if that's a difference across the board, or, you know?
Yeah, that's a good observation. The hugging is and sort of physical displays of affection are not something that people in China have traditionally done. And I think what that scene that you saw in that documentary, which I've heard about but have not seen, was very typical. You know, when I went with this young woman, Min, back to her family village, you know, when she first saw her mother for the first time in 2 years, they just kind of, she touched her arm lightly and that was it, you know. And that kind of reflects sort of this traditional Chinese feeling, I think, that you don't display your emotions too much, but everything's quite restrained and under the surface. I think that's pretty common. I mean, what's interesting now in China is when you meet quite worldly people, they're sort of learning these behaviors, things like, you know, shaking hands and hugging and sort of doing the things. But in many cases, they've seen this behavior when they've traveled abroad or sometimes even on television, you know, and sort of learned from that.
You write sort of amusingly in the book about most of the time it seems as if you could completely pass for a native-born Chinese when you chose to, but then once in a while you'd have to play the American card if you needed something. I'm wondering how long it took you after you arrived there to be able to go undetected as an American.
Do you mean after I started reporting the factory town? Or
I guess I mean how long after you arrived in China to work even for the journal?
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, physically, I'm ethnic Chinese, so I can blend in if I want, as long as I don't open my mouth, because I do speak Chinese, but I speak with kind of an accent, so people will sometimes pick up on that. I think it was more kind of getting used to being a reporter in China and gradually realizing certain things that you should do to not draw attention to yourself. You know, obviously, taking out a notebook and writing in English is the worst possible thing you could do, because suddenly a huge crowd is... And it's not like police or whatever. It's just a huge crowd watching you write English because they're really fascinated by it. Another thing I learned never to do is to, you know, never take out a document or anything, because people get really like, oh, what is that? You know, they want to see that, and they think it's some, like, secret information or something. So there are a lot of things I picked up just being a reporter in China over the years about just kind of keeping a low profile, not attracting attention, especially official attention. But, you know, one of the surprising things about Dongguan, this, you know, huge factory city of, you know, 8 or 9 million people, was that there was almost no government presence. And I kept expecting at some point someone would discover that I was a journalist and start asking me questions or making trouble for me. But, you know, no one ever asked me what I was doing. And I think that was sort of emblematic of the place, that everyone was so focused on doing their own thing that they couldn't be bothered seeing what I was doing, which was fine.
That can be helpful, I guess, in your line of work. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Leslie T. Chang. The new book is called Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China. Let's go next to Ardith in Dallas. Hi, Ardith.
Hi. My question is, if these migrant workers leave their parents behind on the farm and eventually they pass on, what happens to the agricultural economy? Who's going to raise the food crops that are needed by this country? Will it go corporate, much like it has happened in this country?
Yeah, that's actually something that is changing as we speak. What my general feeling is that, you know, Chinese farms are very small. The average farm is about an acre. So what that means is that even though these young people are going out to the cities to work, there's usually enough people left at home, maybe just an older father or mother who can farm the land on their own, because there's so little work to be done. But in this next generation, I think we're going to see large numbers of people leave the farms forever. And as this older generation dies off, that's a very valid question: who's going to farm the land? And just lately, we've actually seen that Chinese officials are discussing new policies that will allow people in the countryside to buy and sell land for the first time. And it's not clear when these new rules will be implemented, but it's clear that the government realizes, you know, there's going to be a large number of people leaving, and we need to allow people to buy and sell the land. And eventually, I think we're going to see larger, you know, commercial farms, consolidation of land, just as we've seen in America, you know, over the past century. But it might take a while for all this to work itself out.
We're really familiar, particularly in this part of the country, with the idea that migrant workers who've come from Mexico are expected very often to send money back home, and that money, certainly, those remittances are changing the economy of parts of rural Mexico. And I know there's an expectation in most Chinese families that if someone goes to the city, they will send money back home when it's available. How is that changing the way that these little rural villages look and the way they operate?
Yeah, it's changing a lot. You know, these young people go out to the city and they spend and they send home a huge amount of money. In fact, these remittances from the cities to the countryside are already the largest source of income, of cash accumulation in rural China. And they're basically what people are using to build houses and buy fertilizer and put younger children through school. So, you know, almost every migrant I met when they first came out, they would send a big chunk of their earnings home. You know, Min, the younger woman I write about, she would make, say, 600 yuan a month, and she would keep 100, which is maybe, you know, $12, and then send the rest home, you know, $70 home to her parents. And she did that over a couple of years. But then again, after they're in the city for a while, they start to think more, well, I've done a lot for my family. Now I need to start worrying about myself. So they'll often set up a bank account and put money there for themselves, even though their parents might object to that. You know, they have the power and the leverage to do that on their own now.
What are the first kinds of status symbols? I think it's Min who goes out. The first thing she buys is a cute little outfit for herself when she gets her first month's wages. Mm-hmm. Is that what people initially spend money on when they feel flush with cash for the first time?
Yeah, they might buy a nice outfit. Another big thing is hair, you know, coloring your hair, getting a nice hairdo in a nice salon. When Min got her first full month's pay, she spent a huge chunk of it on straightening her hair, which I thought was really interesting. The first kind of big purchase of most migrants is a mobile phone. That's usually, you know, a mobile phone is basically an essential thing to have in a place as mobile and fluid as Dongguan, because people are jumping jobs so often that if you don't have a mobile phone, it's just impossible to keep in touch or even to, you know, apply for a new job. You know, that's the way people get in touch with you. So having a new mobile phone was sort of the first big sign that they had arrived in the city.
And then when she lost her phone, she had all kinds of problems.
Yeah. Once she lost her phone, she sort of lost touch with a huge network of people she met in the city and sort of had to start building her network from scratch.
Leslie T. Chang is with us. We'll return to our discussion of her new book, Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China, after this break. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email us at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Leslie T. Chang. Her new book is called Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Muye in Plano. Hi, Muye.
Hi. I have a question. I would like to know that, because recently I heard that there's a lot of factory moving out of Dongguan, all those factory cities. Now, I want to know that what would happen to these factory girls if they lost their job?
Yeah, there have been, you know, in recent years, a lot of factories choose to set up in the smaller provincial cities, for one, because the costs are much cheaper there. So what you're seeing is a different kind of migration where people go shorter distances from home and maybe go home on the weekends or go home once a month. So that's partly where those factories are going. And in terms of the, you know, China's economy is gradually changing. And, for example, some of the really small, worst-run toy factories in Dongguan have closed down in the last year. In terms of how this impacts individual workers, I think, you know, some of them will just jump, you know, as these little factories are closing down, you know, better factories or bigger factories are opening up all the time, so I think they'll just jump to another factory. And in the worst case, you know, these workers sometimes will go home and spend a few months there and then come back out again. You know, we saw that in the over the past decade when the economy slowed. People would, you know, go home in pretty large numbers and spend a few months doing some local work and then come back out when conditions improved. And I think that's what we'll see. again, I think there's a lot of resilience in the economy, and I think there's also just so much pent-up labor in the countryside that needs to go somewhere that it will continue to flow out to the cities.
So this new tradition of people leaving rural areas and going into the factories in the cities is a relatively new thing in China. Do you think, though, that the next generation of Chinese young people will be willing to take these kinds of jobs? Or if their parents have a bit of education and a bit of money, will they not be interested in jobs that pay relatively little?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of these workers, you know, who I write about will eventually settle down in the cities and live basically middle-class lives, and that their children will grow up and in the cities and definitely will not want to have these factory jobs. So what we'll see, though, is that there are still a lot of, you know, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people who are living in rural China, and young people who are coming up through the schools who will want to come out and work. And then, you know, as for 20 years down the road, how it's going to play out, I'm not sure. You know, I think probably at that point, a lot of these very low-wage, low-skilled jobs will have migrated out of China and hopefully be replaced by more high-skilled jobs that people will want to do.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Gina in Flower Mound. Hey, Gina.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, as these young ladies go to the city, are they easily tempted into a more risky lifestyle of prostitution, or do they get into drugs? And if they do, what is the factory... How does the factory get involved in getting them back on the straight and narrow, or do the girls then get sent back home, and how are they received once they do go back home? Thank you.
Yeah, I actually spent a big chunk of time in Dongguan exploring that exact question, was what happens to these young women who choose to become prostitutes, many of them working in the thousands of karaoke bars in Dongguan. And what I found was really interesting, one was that the decision to work as a prostitute was surprisingly casual. It wasn't like a calculation to make a lot more money or this very cynical ploy. It was usually just, well, my cousin or someone from the village was doing it, and they told me it was a pretty good job, so I decided to do it. And another thing I noticed with that was that these young women who worked in the karaoke bars as prostitutes often had better financial and educational backgrounds than the young women I knew who worked in factories. And even though this seemed really surprising, it, you know, when you think about it, it makes sense, because I think when they came out to the city, they had higher expectations. They didn't want to do the lowliest work. They wanted to make some money and have some nice clothes and a nicer lifestyle. And prostitution, frankly, you know, for all the terrible side of the work that they did, it was a lot, you know, shorter hours and much, much better pay. You know, these young prostitutes I met, they could make in a month what someone in a factory could make in a year. So many women chose that route because, I mean, they sort of fell into it because someone they knew did it, and then they decided to stay on it because they felt like, you know, this is a much better way to make money. And in terms of what happens to them, I mean, first of all, the factories have no say over what they do, and also no concern over what happens to them. So no one is trying to rescue them or send them back home, anything like that. They're basically on their own. But, you know, I think because there's so much fluidity in Chinese society today that plenty of women can, you know, if they're motivated and organized, they can work as a prostitute for a couple years, save some money, and then go back, move to another city and set up a shop, you know, a hair salon or a tailoring business or a store or something like that. I mean, that was sort of the path that many prostitutes I talked to were hoping to take. And I think, you know, many of them fall off the path, but some of them do succeed in doing that.
Kelly writes to say that one of his children is adopted from China, as are so many other adoptees. Do you foresee any impact on China in the coming decades as adopted girls raised in the West begin to focus on their homeland, either as activists or as returnees?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting population. And I've noticed this as a reporter and writer, is that the families who have adopted children from China are incredibly interested in China and engaged. And, you know, I get all sorts of passionate letters from parents of adopted children. And now we're seeing this first wave of girls who are now, you know, coming of age, going to college. And I think that many of them will choose to, focus on China in some way, learning the language, hopefully, you know, possibly going there to work. So I think this is a really, actually, a very interesting population and a good opportunity, hopefully to build more bridges between China and the U.S. and to create greater understanding. Because, you know, when young people learn the language, learn Chinese early, and go to China to work, what they see is completely different, you know, more complete and more nuanced, I think, than going there much later or not speaking the language. So I think there's a great opportunity there for understanding on both sides.
What sort of pressure is there on migrant factory girls in China to get married?
Oh, it's huge. they come out from the village, but there's still a lot of traditional thinking at work, you know, in their parents' lives and in their own minds as well. So there's a lot of pressure for them to marry in their early 20s, hopefully to someone from their home near their home village, and then to have a child or children. So that's part of what made a lot of the factory girls I met so determined to rise up, was they felt like they had this, you know, limited window of a couple years to prove themselves and to do something, and otherwise they felt like their parents would give them a lot of pressure to get married soon, and they wouldn't have anything to say to them, you know. But if they were earning a little bit more money and, you know, had risen up a little in the world, then they could talk back to their parents and say, no, I'm not going to get married now. And it was really interesting, Chun Ming, the older woman I write about in her diary from her early days, you know, in one of the letters to her parents that she copied out in her diary, she said, I am absolutely determined that until I have some accomplishments, I will not get married, you know. Mm. And she felt very clearly that marriage would limit her prospects.
On the other hand, you say that Chinese personal ads read often more like real estate listings.
Yeah, you know, that's sort of the pragmatic side of China. You know, people, you know, one chapter of the book is about kind of dating practices in Dongguan and online dating and dating agencies and all sorts of quite interesting and entertaining side of life. And, you know, one thing you notice when you go through the personal ads is that there isn't any of this, you know, walks on the beach, hot air balloon rides, and all the things we as Americans dream of. Instead, it's sort of, I want someone who works hard, you know, I want someone with a steady income. And a lot of them would come out and say, I want someone who has a car and an apartment. and I don't think this necessarily means that everyone's just incredibly greedy and materialistic. I think it just reflects that people want some kind of security and want to know they're marrying someone who has similar ambitions as they do.
How sexually liberated are young Chinese women?
Quite liberated, I would say. I guess it's not as liberated as Americans are, but, you know, there are people who are dating in college or people who are dating as factory workers, you know, 18, 19, 20, you know, is common to live together. It's probably more common in the factory world than in college because they're so far away from the prying eyes of their parents and other villagers. So surprisingly, they would come from a very traditional village life and then live this extremely liberated city life. And I think this created conflicts and disjunctions, you know, to sort of hold these two opposite ideas in their heads at the same time. And even the women who are very liberated would often say to me, I feel really guilty that I'm not married and giving a grandchild to my parents. You know, they still felt the traditional side, even if they were living very modern lives.
I'm curious about what you think about this. There are so many Americans who avoid buying Chinese-made goods because they worry about exploitation of people who work in these factories. And certainly it sounds like the conditions there are nothing like the standards that we set for labor here. And yet they're also, it sounds like for many people, the only opportunity they have to get out of even worse poverty.
That's right. Yeah, I'm really mixed about this sort of, you know, how we as American consumers can influence Chinese behavior, because, you know, I know it comes from good intentions, but the reality is, you know, as I feel like I portrayed in this book, that even working in a really crummy factory can be an avenue to something better. And it's really hard for us from so far away to choose, well, this factory is good, this one's bad, this one is helping people, this one's not. You know, I just think that it's very, very complicated. And even the good factories will sometimes buy goods from the bad factories. So, you know, the whole economy is so intertwined that it's really hard to separate out, you know, good versus evil. And, you know, I think our role as Americans is just, you know, to try to understand as much as we can what's going on there, the complexities and the nuances. And, you know, I think that's the more meaningful thing to try to do rather than to pick winners and losers in some place that's so far away that, you know, we don't really know about.
I know that complexity and nuance was those were two things that you felt like you really had to sort of fight against, fight in order to provide when you were working for a mainstream newspaper. Not that the journal wasn't trying hard to get things right, but you had daily deadlines and a limited amount of column inches. How different is telling this kind of story when you have a whole book to write?
Yeah, it's very different, you know. And one big difference is just that I was able to spend so much time before I wrote anything. I spent 2 years with these two migrant women before I started sitting down and writing my book. And what that meant was that you just get a much more complicated, nuanced, rich picture than is possible when, you know, you're working on a newspaper deadlines. And at the Wall Street Journal, I actually had 7 months before I had to write my first migrant story, and I was incredibly grateful to have that kind of time. But even so, most newspaper stories are done on a much shorter time frame, and I think a lot of nuance and a lot of understanding is lost. You know, one thing I realized was, you know, over the 2 years that I knew these two migrant women, that I reported on these two migrant women, there were many times when they were in really dire situations. You know, at one point, Min had her mobile phone and all her earnings stolen, and she was kind of destitute. And Chuming at one point, fled this massage parlor and lost all her money and all her possessions. And so if I'd been kind of a typical reporter and met them at that moment, sat down with them, interviewed them for 2 hours, written a story, it would have been a really dire portrait of migrant life. But, you know, since I was able to spend so much time with them over a couple years, I could see this sort of broader trajectory, and it was a trajectory of improvement, you know, with many ups and downs, certainly, but improvement and opportunity.
Have you given any thought to whether or not you expect to live in China again in the future?
Oh, yeah, I definitely would like to. My husband and I moved back to the States last year because we feel like it's a nice place to live. And there are many sort of untold stories in America as well. We live in a small town in Colorado. And, you know, I think there's a lot that people don't know about or might find interesting. But definitely we do feel that China is an amazing story, and it will continue to be for some time to come. And we'd like to live back there probably a few years from now.
Did you find moving to Colorado that you had to sort of shake off some of the ways that you had learned to do journalism in China?
Well, mostly I've been still working on this book. So I'm still kind of got one foot in China, even though the other foot's in Colorado. I think one obvious thing will be just that the pace is so different. You know, in China you get used to and spoiled by, you know, people's lives changing basically week by week, month by month. And I realize in America now the pace is quite different, and that might mean, you know, different types of stories to be written.
Leslie T. Chang's new book is called Factory Girls, From Village to City in a Changing China. We also interviewed her last May for a piece that was in National Geographic magazine. It was called Gilded Age, Gilded Cage. You can find that online. Leslie, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.